Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
This is Sound Opinions, and even if you don't know the name Rocky Erickson, you certainly know some of the bands he's influenced, from ZZ Top to REM to Acroville River. Later in the show, we'll delve into the influential and psychedelic world of Rocky Erickson, and we'll remember Dr. John, both legends we recently lost. But first, we're going to get a little philosophical about the nature of music, right, Craig?
Yes, Jim, we're going to talk about the book you just released, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, something you've been working on for 19 years. It details your incredible investigation of the R&B star's abuse of power. It seems like every stone has been turned over here in terms of what you went through to write this book, how you approached it, the results. What's the thing you'd most like to share with our audience that you've learned from this experience?
So we started this show 21 years ago, a mere 14 of that on public radio, and it's because we believe in the power of music. What this book is partly doing is asking people to re-examine if this music can save your life, can it also be the ultimate force to corrupt it and ruin it, a source to pervert all that is good about music? And that was, you know, it's never a book I wanted to write. We haven't talked very much on Sound Opinions about R. Kelly. You know, we did do a show separating the art and the artist. You know, I mean, the thought of hurting people, sexual assault, stealing their teenage years, crushing the dream of singing when that was what you wanted to do. And then on top of it all, taking the joy of music out of someone's life. I mean, that's what our whole show's always been about. Yeah. And the flip side of that is just horrifying to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's like stealing a piece of your soul. You know, the ending of your book, not to play spoiler here, is just so damaging, you know, to read that, to just hear what this young lady went through, and the fact that music no longer can sustain her, that she wants to make it or listen to it.
Let me tell her story, Greg. This young woman from Cottage Grove Heights, she was a girl, she was a teenager, she was 15. She sings behind her best friend, Aaliyah, Paris, Amsterdam, Rome, London, tours America. You know, from 91 to 93, Kelly initiates sexual contact with her, she's 15, and six of her 15-year-old friends, and he marries Aaliyah illegally in 94 when she's 15, and Tiffany was the first girl to try to stop him that I know of. Files a lawsuit in 96, settles it out of court with a nondisclosure agreement of the kind we've seen many powerful, wealthy men like Harvey Weinstein use to silence their victims. 19 years later, a couple of months ago, I met with Tiffany. She spoke for the first time, and she never sang again. And not only that, but the ending you were referring to, she can't listen to music anymore at all. And I think about what your life, my life, and dare I say, many Sound Opinions listeners' lives would be like to be robbed, you know, of your teenage years, to have this guilt. I mean, Tiffany had tried to kill herself when this relationship ended. All of the horror of that, and then on top of it, not to have music. But I sat at an event in New York on the day of publication with Tarana Burke. You know, this activist from the Bronx launches hashtag MeToo in 2006. She has started a civil rights conversation, movement, awareness that is spanning the globe with MeToo. And I said, you know, Tarana, I think one of the legacies you're leaving us is we are going to have to much more closely examine the art we consume, that we love, and see if it holds up to the standards by which we try to live our lives.
You know, I think, you know, the industry, the music industry, was operating under 20th century rules where transgression of this sort, maybe not to this scale, but of this sort was, you know, we looked away. It was like, okay, this has nothing to do with the music. It's his private life. You know, we can separate the art from the artist. Here you were working on this book for 19 years. you were detailing these stories in various publications over that time. The case was clear to anybody who chose to read those stories. This was a predator who was allowed to operate in broad daylight by an industry that was an enabler, complicit in what was going on, with the radio industry, the record industry, making money off of R. Kelly records. And then only when the money dried up did they turn their back on him. And I think that's a key point. So, you know, at some point, this moral obligation that this industry has seems to be taken to task in this book. And not only the industry, but the media itself that covers that industry in looking beyond this art versus artist paradigm and realizing that, hey, this private life is equally critical in our ability to appreciate that music.
When you're talking about somebody who is doing deeds that are so monstrous for so long in the full glare of the world spotlight, you know, I'll cut to the chase. I mean, I think we will have no show and people will have no music, not to mention movies or visual art or anything else, if we're going to get into imposing a moral litmus test on everyone who creates art in the future. And I don't think Tarana Burke or the Mute R. Kelly women or any of the activists I've sat and spoken with, they're not saying that. This cancel culture people are talking about, the backlash, right? Bull. What they are saying is, think about the art and realize it means something in the real world. I don't think it's about holding every artist up to moral purity. I don't know. I can still listen to James Brown, Led Zeppelin. Maybe someone can listen to Ryan Adams, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that it's intensely personal, this thing we love. That's why we launch Sound Opinions. If Kelly was your high school prom theme, if it played at your kid's graduation, if it was your wedding song, if it's powered every backyard barbecue and party you've ever been to, Ignition, or I Believe I Can Fly, or Step in the Name of Love, you're being asked to reject part of your own life if you turn off that music. I don't think there's a right or a wrong. I just think we can never, in the music business, allow this sort of thing to happen for so long again and turn a blind eye. I don't think anywhere in life we should be allowing that sort of predation to happen. And obviously the problem is bigger than music, but our show's about music.
Mm-hmm. You've obviously been in work at this for a very long time, and it must have been very frustrating at times to put in all the work and not see, you know, and see R. Kelly continuing to sell out shows and selling records and, you know, pushback from not only the people who were there to protect Kelly, but also from the public at large in sort of their indifference to a lot of what you had been writing about in terms of just speaking with their wallets. You know, we're still supporting this artist fully. In the last year or two, we've seen this turn around in a rather profound fashion. A tipping point being, seeing these women that you had been speaking with for years appearing on, television in the Surviving R. Kelly documentary. What was your perspective on that? You know, were you frustrated that it had taken so long? And what lessons do you hope we will learn from this?
Let's focus on what we do on this show. It is rock criticism, music criticism, right? I am really bothered, and this is the only show that would care to ask about this. By the way, criticism failed. The number of our peers, some of whom who've been on our show, many of whom we respect, all of whom are our colleagues, who for years after his trial and acquittal in 2008, after the allegations continue to come, say, you know, despite all that unpleasantness, the man is a genius.
Unpleasantness. Yeah.
You're talking about the sexual assault of 48 women whose names I know. Lives ruined. But why does Pitchfork, Coachella, and Bonnaroo book R. Kelly in 2013? Why do so many critics, I can name them, but why bother, continue to champion his music? You know, the only other critic besides you whoever got this right from day one was Robert Christgau, who is no fan of mine, but I'll give it to the Dean of American Rock Critics. He had Kelly's number from the beginning.
You know, there's a lot of blame to go around. I think, you know, I remember when the trial came up in 2008, the initial trial, you know, I called up radio stations around Chicago because they're still playing Kelly's music. And you would
they're
ask
still playing
these
it today.
Programmers why they were doing it. And the response was, well, the audience is demanding it. They want to hear this music. They're not telling us not to play it. They want it, you know, and if we don't play it, they're going to go to some other station that is playing it, so we need to compete, and therefore we're going to play it. It was strictly a matter of commerce. Again, there was no moral compass at work here at all, and I think a lot of critics were still operating on that level where it was all about the music, man, and we don't really want to know about this other stuff. You know, it's just going to muddle up the picture. And I think your book has highlighted the fact that, well, yes, indeed, it needs to muddle up the picture. It needs to be a consideration whenever we're talking about art and music. When we come back, the life and legacy of Rocky Erickson. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.